I'm Steve Chaney, the CEO of the American Security Project, and I see a lot of old friends here and some new ones. So let me talk for a second about the American Security Project, founded in 2005 by Hagel, Kerry, Hart, and Rudman, four senators you probably know well. And their thought was to take topical issues and put them from a national security perspective, in particular energy security, nuclear security, climate change, asymmetric operations, terrorism, and American competitiveness. And today's topic fits squarely in our sweet spot here. When we talk about energy security in the Eastern Mediterranean, you can imagine it's energy security, certainly somewhat impacted by climate, no doubt about it. Terrorism and asymmetric operations are going on all over the Maghreb. So we've lined up three great panels this afternoon to talk about energy security in the Eastern Med. So I really appreciate everybody coming. Rules of the game here, it is on the record. We are going to tweet it. I think our hashtag's over there. We will record it, put it up on the website tomorrow. So if you have trouble making notes, we'll have them for you tomorrow. It is on the record. I'll introduce Andrew Holland, my energy fellow, here in just a second. And then he'll moderate the first panel. We'll do a little bit of a Q&A afterwards, and then we'll have a second and the third. I'll moderate the third panel. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Andrew, who's my energy fellow, and let him introduce his panel. Thanks, Andrew.
Great. Thanks, Steve. And thank you all for being here, and thanks to everybody for coming. This is kind of a new topic for us. We haven't delved too much into energy in the Eastern Med and everything yet, but we hope to continue to do this project and continue to delve into it deeper, and someday we'll have the depth of the publications of some of our speakers here today. We've got a great group of speakers, and you know, when I was first starting to work on putting these panels together, I went to, you know, okay, well, what has everybody else written around town? So I went to Tim's work from Brookings, and I went to Sir Michael's work from the German Marshall Fund, and a whole there is a good and growing literature on what the implications of these fines are for energy security, for geopolitics, for security in the region, I'm quite pleased that we've got a number of the great writers on that here today. So before I introduce the panel, I'm going to kind of set the scene for this, and then I'm going to let our panelists talk a little bit. Today's first panel is the geopolitical promise of energy in the Eastern Mediterranean. So basically, what's the potential here? We're not a market affairs think tank. We're not going to tell you what the price of natural gas is or where, what's going up or down or anything like that. This is about the geopolitics, about the national security of countries in the region. And so what are the implications of that? So, I think most of us have probably heard the story that some Israelis tell, that Moses took Israelis through the desert for 40 years and then ended up in the only place in the Middle East that doesn't have any oil. but of course, they didn't talk about what's offshore. And that's now that's changing. So a couple of numbers. Right now, I added it up, and these are EIA numbers from about a year ago, so I'm sure they've changed. But they say about 34 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in estimated proven reserves in the waters of Cyprus, Israel, and the Palestinian Authority. In 2010, the USGS estimated total undiscovered reserves in the Levantine Basin at 122 trillion cubic feet of gas and 2.5 billion barrels of oil. So significantly more potentially to be found out there. We see in the news today that you'll hear names like the Tamar field, Leviathan, Aphrodite, and others. Tamar field in Israel is already producing. Leviathan and Aphrodite in Cyprus are nearing production. And what's so interesting about this for ASP, for those of us in Washington here, is that there really are few external events in geopolitics that really are kind of this deus ex machina sort of thing, this idea that comes out of nowhere, a god from nowhere. This is kind of one of them. People a decade ago were not thinking about this, or at least I wasn't thinking about this, and a lot of the people I talked to weren't. So how does this affect the already existing tensions, relationships, geopolitics in the region? And the way when I look at it, there's kind of two ways that this could go in geopolitics. There's kind of the cooperative model or the competitive model. This kind of goes back to, do countries work together and move towards kind of a cooperative, sustainable status quo that's at a higher level and has win-win benefits? Or is this more of a competitive model where it becomes zero sum and both sides try to exclude others from there? And we see examples for both already happening in the 5 years since these fines have been announced and started to be built up. We see a naval buildup. Turkey has ordered 16 new patrol vessels. Israel has spent $800 million on 4 new naval patrol vessels, specifically for protecting the offshore rigs. Greece and Cyprus have some more financial difficulties over this time period, but they've actually tried some kind of interesting financial moves. The Cypriots have leased a French frigate, all this sort of stuff. So there's examples for this competitive model. But the cooperative model, we've also seen announcements from Jordan and Egypt that they could be buying some of the gas from Israel. And for Egypt in particular, this would be quite interesting because the Egyptians selling gas to Israel was such an important part of the peace treaty of 1979. So it's a turnaround, but that sort of cooperation can continue, and that cooperation can build more cooperation. And pipelines kind of build this mutual dependence. You have a built infrastructure that both countries who share the border with the pipeline going across have a vested interest in protecting. But, of course, that built infrastructure is also a target, and that's what we've seen throughout the last 2 or 3 years with the gas pipeline from Egypt through Sinai into Israel has been a, over and over again, a target of attacks from insurgents in the Sinai. So, bottom line, though, this is kind of a story that's yet to be written. So that's why so many groups like us here in ASP and others around DC are studying it and talking about it. There's a lot of things that still could upset this apple cart, and there's a lot of potential out there as well. So, like I said, we've got a great group today. First, we'll have Tim Boersma. Tim is the fellow and acting director in the Energy and Security and Climate Initiative at Brookings. He was a Transatlantic Academy Fellow in Washington, D.C. He is published like crazy. He's got in a couple of books, he's got, I think the new book is out. Did I see that?
It will. The gas book will be out.
The gas book. Oh, in the fall. Okay. Well, keep an eye out for that. We are very happy to have him. He has a doctorate in international relations from the University of Groningen. And he's a Dutch national. We're happy to have him here. Second is Zach Gold. Zach specializes in security in the Sinai Peninsula and relations among Egypt, Israel, Gaza, and the United States. From 2011 to 2014, he served as a researcher at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy. He's been a research associate for the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. He's traveled widely across the region. He currently lives in Tel Aviv, and we're lucky to have him here today. And he's also an adjunct fellow here at ASP. So with that, I'm going to ask each of them to talk for, 10, 15 minutes about this. I'll have a couple of questions, and then we can open it up to the audience here for questions as well. So thank you. And Tim, thank you. Over to you.
Okay. Thanks very much. Thanks, Andrew, for inviting me. Thanks to ASB, of course. Great to be here, and great to be on panel with my highly regarded former Brookings colleague, Zach Gold. Very good to be here. So thanks. The topic of Eastern Mediterranean energy has received very significant attention as compared to the in all honesty size of the fines on a global scale. Very significant attention, and I think that if all the signed memorandums of understanding would give you a reliable indication, one would think that this is a win for everybody. Now, the reality, as I'm sure all of you know, is often a lot more complex. And finding resources as such does not have to be a guarantee at all that a resource will, first of all, be developed, second of all, be marketed successfully. So there's a whole lot more to it. Many analysts have hinted, and Andrew hinted at this as well, at the complex political relations in the region, and at first that's what one would think could complicate matters greatly. Those regions may prohibit or at least complicate the development and the extractive distribution of resources in the region. My main argument, however, will be that next to those interstate relations, which undeniably are very complex, domestic politics have so far also been a major prohibitive factor in the process of developing resources. So in the next few minutes, I'll briefly outline a policy brief that my colleague Natan Zaks and I have written and published in February. You'll find a copy of the paper just outside if you're interested. The research was done for that paper was done in June of last year when we were in Israel and later on in the West Bank. We wrote a second paper on the Gaza Marine Field, which is a relatively modest field just offshore the Gaza Strip, which I will not discuss in great detail, but I'd be happy to talk more about during Q&A. So in the summer of 2012, three developments we think converged, which urged policymakers in Israel to overhaul its sort of existing energy security strategy. The first was a repeated attack on a pipeline running from Egypt through the Sinai to Israel, which Zach, I think, will talk in more detail about, which in combination with the very uncertain outlook for Egypt after the fall of the Mubarak regime, led to immediate energy shortages in not just Israel, but also Jordan, which is connected to that pipeline as well. Second developments, which started roughly a decade before, seemed at the same time to offer an ideal solution. Since 1999, a number of gas fields has been discovered offshore Israel, and also, as you rightly indicated, offshore Cyprus. The most significant one being the Tamar field, which Andrew alluded to, which was discovered in 2009. And the Leviathan field, which was discovered the year after and estimated to be about twice the size of Tamar. Third development, in the summer of 2011, there were mass demonstrations in Israel calling for social reforms. They were not just about energy, of course. But this sentiment, we believe, did greatly influence the debates about energy resources that followed in the years after. It was very logical, of course, that debates about taxation and regulation, potential exports, environmental concerns, and antitrust issues had never been seriously debated in Israel, given that it had always been an import-dependent country. So these were debates that were new to the country. Much of what generally are fairly technocratic debates now became subject, however, to wide public scrutiny and popular political pressure. And consequently, the public mood turned partly to the so-called tycoons, one of them being the owner of Delek, which is part of the consortium that made all the major discoveries, including the Tamar and the Leviathan field. I'll now briefly discuss some major challenges that the authorities have been dealing with since and how that played out and some of these processes are ongoing. First is ownership and revenue. Under an existing law, which dated from 1952, royalties for companies that were extracting a natural resource were set at 12.5%. But the debate following the discovery suggested that some thought that this was too favorable for private sector actors. Companies argued, of course, that during the course of the game, it would be not wise to change the rules of the game, as companies tend to argue. The government in 2010 installed a committee headed by Professor Shishinsky, And what follows was to sort of lay out the options and get an international comparison of what royalty revenues were sort of acceptable and normal around the world. And what followed was a highly politicized debate, resulting in the committee's recommendation to leave the royalty regime in place, but to eliminate a 27% depletion allowance and introducing a progressive excess profit tax, essentially meaning that after 150% of the exploration and exploitation costs had been recovered, a progressive tax would be installed, which would grow from 20 to 50%. Second topic that then came on the agenda was exports of natural gas from Israel. With the discovery of major reserves, Israel solved one fundamental national security issue, which is dependence on outside suppliers, which for me as a Dutch is always an issue, and in Europe more broadly is of course an issue that's being debated. In Israel, and I appreciate this very much, this is an even more contentious issue, obviously, given its position in the region and the relations that the country has with most of its neighbors. Companies involved were, however, in addition to selling the natural gas in the domestic market, given the modest size of that market, of course, also very interested to look at the opportunity to sell some of the product abroad. That debate, too, became contentious, with the public arguing that exports were not in the public interest. And so in 2011, the government appointed a committee headed by Shaul Tzemach, which was tasked to examine energy policy, including export licenses. Similar to the previous debate, the companies involved warned that if the terms of business were not favorable, the gas might well stay in the ground. Eventually, the Tzemach committee recommended to keep roughly 40% of the estimated reserves for domestic usage, and the rest could be exported. In 2013, the government decided, under substantial public pressure, that amount of natural gas to stay in the country had to be raised to about 19,000 billion cubic feet, which is about 60%, close to 60% of the estimated reserves at the time. Depending on consumption levels, that would be roughly 33 decades of natural gas consumption for the domestic market, a little over 30 years. It's also important to know that by that time, as Andrew was mentioning, the Tamar field was actually producing natural gas. So the smaller of the two big finds had started to produce gas. Third issue would be monopoly and pricing. The rationale in the previous discussions had been that the energy market in Israel is in fact a market. Now, that's debatable to say the least. The production of gas is dominated by a consortium which is led by Noble Energy, a Texas-based energy company, and Delek, an Israeli energy company, and they pretty much own the market. Production of electricity in the country, which was projected to use more and more natural gas for electricity generation, is dominated by one company as well, which is the Israel Electrical Company, the IEC. So in principles, I would argue, and here my much respected author, co-author Natan and I diverge a little bit, in principle, monopolies, or dominant suppliers for that matter, don't have to be problematic. But what you do need is a strong regulatory authority that can intervene if necessary. Now, my view is that in the case of Israel, that is debatable as well. So what followed was again a contentious debate about monopoly power and pricing of energy in Israel. And this debate is ongoing. So several options have been discussed, one of them being to sell one of the major fields, which, you know, after discovering two major fields, being forced or suggested that you have to sell one of them is a pretty drastic measure to propose. The other is installing price controls, which have been debated as well. But here, you know, you could ask, okay, how can you install price controls if, you know, companies haven't abused their power to date? So currently, the antitrust authority is debating with the consortium whether its dominance can be ended by breaking up the monopoly. After the consortium was declared a cartel by that same antitrust authority in December of last year. The Public Utilities Authority, which is the other regulator, issued a statement saying that it wanted to nullify the existing contracts between Tamar and the IEC on the grounds of overpricing and excessive take-or-pay levels, so forcing the buyer to take a certain amount of natural gas, regardless of demand for electricity. The outcomes of these debates are ongoing. Surely post-elections, it remains to be seen how they will evolve. Some have suggested that post-elections, it would be easier to smoothen out this process. It may be the case. There's very little public information at this point. Some indications that the government does want to push this forward with, for instance, the signing, I think last week, the consent of the Israeli authorities to sell natural gas to several Jordan buyers, which had been long debated as well. But in sum, I think domestic politics has greatly complicated the development of the gas discoveries in Israel. It's uncertain at this point whether, and I would say even when, the Leviathan field, which is the biggest field that has been found globally over the last decade, when that will be developed, and to what extent the ongoing political turmoil has affected the domestic investment climate. But it hasn't boded well. Now, if all these barriers are overcome eventually, which may well happen, then a whole range of international challenges await. And I think that's where Zach can take over. Thank you.
Over to you, Zach.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim, for that introduction. Thanks, of course, to ASP, to Andrew and Paul for inviting me to be here today. Tim, it's an honor to be here alongside you. And for those of you who have yet to read Tim's work along with Natan Sachs, I definitely recommend it. So thanks for that great overview. It saves me from talking about the domestic point of view. I, of course, need to get back to Tel Aviv and pay my bill to the Israeli electric company. So I'll be as brief as I can. It's in some ways unfortunate that this panel is titled Opportunities, because I think Tim was a bit of a downer with domestic issues, and now I'm afraid that I'm going to continue on the depressing front with the international geopolitics of it all. As Andrew mentioned, my name is Zach Gold, and in addition to being affiliated here with ASP, I am a visiting fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv, where I focus on Egyptian security and relations between Egypt and Israel. And of course, INSS has been very involved in looking at the strategic opportunities and challenges of Israel's offshore gas finds. Indeed, we had a conference December 18th entitled Israel, the U.S., and the Changing Strategic Shifting Energy Landscape. And I just want to give you a couple highlights from that, because the main outcome, one of the main points that was given by Shaul Zemach, the former Director General of Israel's Energy Ministry, and it came through from a number of speakers as well, was that Israel's export priority is the neighborhood, specifically Jordan and Egypt. These are the priorities, as put forward by Zemach, and it was also put forward by a number of the panelists and speakers, including our guest, Amos Hochstein, with whom you're probably familiar, the U.S. Special Envoy for Energy, who joined us for that discussion. The main takeaway, for why the region is so important is simply cost. The cost advantage to exporting to the neighbors versus exporting through LNG abroad or through very long pipelines to Europe. So simply put, the priority is on the region because it's cost effective to export to the region. Our conference, of course, being on December 18th, also included a very good I told you so moment when the energy minister, the economy minister, Naftali Bennett, said that if red tape is not dealt with on the Israeli side, that it would hinder the free flow of natural gas. As Tim has mentioned, that was December 18th, less than a week before the antitrust authorities reneged on their previous agreement and called the partners in the Leviathan and Tamar fields monopoly, putting things up in the air. On the sidelines of the conference, Hochstein spoke with Bloomberg Business News and said that he was certain that self-interest in Egypt, in Jordan, and in Turkey would overcome these many political obstacles. And indeed, he was sure that gas would eventually flow from the Israeli fields to neighboring countries. This is, of course, the hope, one into which Hochstein and his team have put a great deal of effort from the U.S. side, brokering agreements and talks and sitting down with various parties to try to make these regional regional political obstacles, less of obstacles in the business sense. Because, of course, from a pure economic sense, as Tim mentioned, as Andrew mentioned, it simply makes sense to export to your neighbors when you are in a gas-producing state and your neighbors are giant energy-consuming countries. This, from an economic standpoint, makes sense. However, you know, economic interests don't always defeat political interests and political obstacles. And one thing that I would note is that Israel's interests in the sale of natural gas to its neighbors is more than simply financial. Israel has long looked for ways to be a normal, active player in its region, a region that has long tried to keep it outside of normalcy. And attempting to be an accepted player in the region has often been led by Israel's business community. In fact, it was Israeli business, the Delta Group, a underwear manufacturer, that following the peace treaty with Jordan led to the most successful Israeli trade agreement, regional agreement to date, the qualified industrial zones. Simply showing that business leads the industry. At the same time, the QIZs show an example of opportunities where Israel has put its politics over its economic and diplomatic self-interest. QIZs support low-tech jobs in Israel's periphery, areas where people are unskilled and where there is a need for jobs. However, it is Israeli policy not to expand the QIZs to the annoyance and frustration of the Egyptians, as long as Israeli citizen Uda Tarabin is imprisoned in Egypt. So again, that's an example of politics trumping economic self-interest. And the Egyptians themselves don't always put economic self-interest before security interests or other interests. If we look to the recent and very successful economic conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, one of the key pillars of moving Egypt's economy forward was a return of tourism. 2 days after the conference, without input from the tourist ministries or tourism industry, the state announced that it would be making tourist visas more cumbersome for those trying to come to Egypt. Now, of course, there's some debate on when this will go into effect, but simply put, it shows that there are times when the security interests and security sectors of a state will interfere with with normal economy and politics. While I'm on the topic of Egypt's intelligence and security bodies, I would note that if we look at the 2005 agreement to sell gas to Israel, one of the arguments for, or at least justifications of, a lower price of gas was reportedly that the intelligence agencies in Egypt thought it would be good to have leverage over Israel, making Israel dependent on Egyptian energy. Of course, with the pendulum now swinging in the other direction, it'll be very important to see how Egypt and how these bodies view that dependency on Israeli gas. So again, we see a lot of political obstacles. Of course, there are several openings, and we've talked about a couple of them on this podium, and especially this is the case now with Egypt more so than with Turkey. Turkey is still throwing up major political obstacles as part of its policy before importing Israeli gas. Egypt, at least, is open to the idea. And it is certainly easier to overcome these hurdles on the Egyptian political front as long as there is not a parliament to publicly debate whether or not they'll give permission for a deal. So let's look very quickly at the March 17th agreement. It is the only finalized agreement between the Tamar partners and an Egyptian company, the Dolphinus Holdings, which itself is a bit unknown. But the deal itself was signed, but there are several approvals needed. Now, again, if we assume that the politics can be taken care of, so Israel will give its export approval and Egypt will give its import approval, there are two other major parts of this. One is that the partners need to make a deal with the Israel gas lines. That's straightforward enough, not really a problem to pump gas from the Tamar field to Ashkelon. Then you have the necessity of getting the gas into an already existing pipeline, the Eastern Mediterranean Gas Company pipeline from Ashkelon to Arish. Here's where things get complicated. And here's where this, of course, according to the deal, if anyone has read the agreement itself, is on Delfinus to create this, to make the deal with the EMG partners. EMG, as probably everyone in this room knows, has a multi-billion dollar arbitration case against Egyptian gas and petroleum because of the cutoff of fuel in 2012. And as business reporters Farah Halim and Rachel Williamson have noted, it's very unlikely that EMG will give up this opportunity for billions of dollars for the maybe up to $10 million they could make from pumping this gas through. The deal between Delfinus and the partners is also detrimental to EMG because it says that Delfinus would have veto authority over other gas traveling through the pipeline, which meant that even if the partners were to sell to other Egyptian holders, it would be up to Delfinus to say, sure, it can go through EMG as well. So again, all of these complications without even looking at the geopolitical security issues, which I'm glad that both Andrew and Tim mentioned, because security threats to the infrastructure are the other main problem, and this is the real where geopolitics really come into it. My friend and colleague Allison Good has written a lot about Israel's defense budget and its need to protect the gas fields, and I suppose the good thing from a regional point of view is that whether Israel exports its energy or not, the fields and the infrastructure still need to be protected. So that budget is in many ways a sunk cost, although if they're exporting to regional partners, there will be there should be and will be shared burdens. So we look, of course, at the Sinai pipeline. So now everything's been settled. The politics are out of the way. EMG has agreed to let go arbitration, and you have gas flowing to Arish, where the EGAS system has been bombed more than 30 times since before Mubarak's ouster in 2011. Of course, the majority of those 29 and over have been after the ouster itself. And indeed, we have seen times where the pipeline is bombed, even though no gas has been flowing through it, simply because, frankly, there are rumors, and every so often the Egyptian government will speak to the rumors, that gas is flowing secretly through the pipeline. And so perhaps in some ways because it's just a check, and in some ways because, well, it's exposed, Ansar Beit al-Maqdis and others will blow up the gas pipeline from Arish to Israel, from Arish to Jordan, and from Arish to an industrial zone in Sinai itself. In addition to the internal problems in Egypt, you have external problems. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has publicly threatened the offshore infrastructure, and unlike other groups, they have the capacity to actually target it. Of course, Hamas is another group that could benefit from the chaos of targeting the offshore fields or the Ashkelon terminal. They have less capacity to do so, but again, it's within the realm of possibility. We've also seen in the 2014 war that Hamas used naval commandos to breach the Israeli border going around. If we assume that they're operating naval commandos to breach the border, we can also think that they would attempt to get near the pipeline infrastructure or the wells themselves. Finally, and for thinking about non-state actors, and I know when Andrew talked about the defense budgets and the state competition, he was probably thinking about the Turkish Navy running through the Cypriot fields, which of course is also an issue. But the final thing I want to touch on is non-state actors, and we've seen the Islamic State operating in offshore in the Mediterranean, in the Eastern Mediterranean. It's assumed, although there is very little proof, but it is assumed that the Islamic State is moving people from Syria to Libya to Sinai via the Mediterranean Sea, not in large numbers, but in small numbers, and small numbers are all that matters. In fact, we saw in November of this past year, the Islamic State hijacked an Egyptian naval ship. And that shows, again, their capabilities, their targets, and also the necessity of the Egyptians to increase their Coast Guard and naval capacity. So, again, looking at all of these regional issues, there are opportunities for breaking through the politics. But that increases a number of other risks and another amount of security costs. So I think similar to Tim, it's a little uncertain where things are going now. And certainly I'm looking forward to the discussion with Andrew and with the rest of you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Zach. That's great. A little bit less optimistic, maybe, than some other people you'll say, but I think that's realism is more in a good idea than otherwise. Zach, I wanted to kind of pick up on something you were talking about. You were saying kind of politics and economics, and it seems like sometimes they work together, sometimes and sometimes they work kind of opposed. And I wonder if you could kind of build on that, or how do you get the politics and the economics to kind of work in the same
that's
direction?
That's a great question, and it's one if we look at Egypt, I think that if there are going to be deals signed with Egypt, now is the time to strike for two reasons. One, opposition in Egypt is hampered in a great deal on all fronts, especially on relations with Israel. But two, the country is in a desperate, dire energy situation. Now, Egypt has a short-term fix. Earlier this month, they landed an LNG liquefaction terminal. It's a very difficult word. to be able to bring in LNG, which they had never done before, and they've purchased, I believe, about 35 shipments of LNG going forward 5 years, so that they to sort of have a stopgap in their power. And of course, energy stability is going to be one of the biggest challenges to the Egyptian government, especially as we go into summer. I was just in Egypt last month, and during my time there, the power started to cut out again, something that we hadn't seen in some time. And the lines again started to form for petrol. So certainly Egypt is returning to an energy crunch, one that has been pretty consistent, basically because of a lack of investment in its fields. Of course, we have seen an increase in investment now in Egypt. 40-some billion dollars worth of exploration have been signed in the past couple months. And British Petroleum, BP itself, just discovered reserves off of the offshore Egypt that they estimate to be about 5 trillion cubic feet, which of course can play into the regional competition, if you will. Why would Egypt and companies in Egypt buy from the Leviathan field if they have this opportunity offshore themselves? Over another period of time. But what we have anyway is, because of the energy crunch, it's an opportunity for Egypt to make up that gas by buying from the Israeli fields. Now this comes with a lot of politics and a lot of political baggage that Jordan does not have. Again, going back to the 2005 deal that many, many Egyptians saw as corrupt, as a boon for the friends of Mubarak, as losing millions of dollars, if not more, for the Egyptian economy because of the price. So there's a lot of baggage with buying Israeli gas and with buying with being dependent on Israeli gas. We saw a very popular Egyptian TV host recently called the Red Dead deal, which is simply a water supply deal to Jordan. He called it a bomb on the Arab region. Simply that despite 34 or 35 years of peace, there is still a culture of anti-normalization and a culture of seeing Israel as the enemy and as a threat. And so you don't want to be dependent on that. So that said, there are opportunities for the Tamar partners and the Leviathan partners, for as long as they remain the Tamar and Leviathan partners, to sell to, again, the LNG plants in Egypt are not Egyptian companies. They are European companies. BG and UFG are to export LNG back to Europe. And so there are opportunities in that. And again, this is another economic interest thing because these companies, UFG has arbitration with Egypt because of the cutoff, and they're companies that are owned billions of dollars by Egypt. So if Egypt accepts the deals with to buy part from Leviathan or from Tamar, it is pretty much, it's been pretty much bluntly stated by the Minister of Petroleum, not pretty much, it has been bluntly stated by the Minister of Petroleum in Egypt that Egypt will only give approval to these purchases, and again, because it's on Egyptian territory that approval is necessary, Egypt will only give approval if the arbitration is dropped and other favorable deals. So it is an opportunity where the economics and the politics meet because Egypt already owns these international companies so much money, it is able to, in many ways, frankly, blackmail them out of that money and out of these arbitrations so that the LNG plants in term, can be processing again.
Hmm. Interesting. Thank you. Tim, question for you. You had talked about throughout the process that there was some comparison, international comparison to other new energy producers and everything like that. I wonder if you could expand a little bit more. What are the kind of historical or cross-country analogies for, you know, what happens when a small country suddenly finds, you know, like you say, it's not a huge field, but it's a significant field, especially in a relatively small economy. You know, what is the... are there lessons for how to set up that industry, and are there lessons for, you know, what's worked, what hasn't worked? You know, we're seeing, for example, Brazil right now having lots of problems getting their offshore oil system up and running. I know Netherlands back in the 70s with the gas fines. Anything else?
I think it's extremely difficult to make those comparisons because all these cases are different, because local conditions are different, local politics are. So I, you know, as much as I appreciated the effort of the Israeli authorities and the installation of the Shishinsky Committee, you know, you should not, in my view, add too much value to it in the sense that what decisions made in either the Netherlands or in Brazil or other places do not necessarily work well for Israel, and so I think that's I think the most important thing, and I think this is where my concern in terms of this particular case comes from, is that what does not work is during a process changing rules over and over again. What works is having rules in place and leaving them there. Now, obviously, if in that process you turn from a importer of energy to a potential exporter, that changes the equation. And it's understandable that the authorities said, well, wait a minute, we need to reconsider existing legislation, which was clearly not geared for this new situation. But it's wise to sit down with those that you actually need to get the gas out of the ground and come to a sort of mutual understanding, which in which all actors need to be satisfied, if you will. To, if I may, briefly get back to your earlier point, I hate to be the guy that rains on the parade, and I think it's important, and I didn't want to come across as being extremely negative about this case. I think it's important, so there's two things that are important. One, first and foremost, the Tamar field is producing, of course, and Israel has a number of decades of natural gas, which it can look forward to, right? And that production from that field stops is not very likely. So that's a very significant change for Israel and a very significant change for the region as well, I would guess. The next question is whether maybe some of Israel's neighbors, particularly the ones, well, all of them are in dire need of energy, but particular large demand growth in Turkey and in Egypt, as Zach described. The big question is whether some of these resources can be used for those purposes as well and to satisfy some of those needs. I don't think that's a given. I think that's complicated, given the complicated relations between these countries and all the sensitivities in the region. But it's not all doom and gloom. So there's, right, Israel does have these fines. There is production going on since March 2013 from the Tamar field. It's good to see these things in proportion as well. It is a major find, and one of the major finds in the last decade. On a global scale, sure, Israel is not going to be a global gas player. It doesn't have to be either, right? If it could be a regional player, and if some of its neighboring countries could benefit from this in the short term, that would be Jordanian buyers, maybe in the longer run Egyptian, maybe someday even Turkish buyers, although at this point in time that seems like wishful thinking with the very sour relations between the two. But who knows, right? These things can change. It seems to me that that authorities in both Istanbul, Ankara, and in Israel can be pragmatic as well. And so one has a lot of natural gas, there's a lot of demand on the other side. Well, you know, it may just as well be that they find a way to work together going forward. Yeah. Who knows? I think that's the big challenge going forward.
Yeah, and the Turks have talked about wanting to be this regional gas hub for, you know, other gas coming through the southern corridor.
Yes. Well, there's many factors. Turkey is another case itself, but there's many factors that are uncertain there. I mean, the Turks are positioned well, they feel, and they may well be, to be a gas hub. Don't want to be a transit state to Europe, like Ukraine has been, but would rather be a sort of a transit, sort of a hub, a trading hub. But many potential sources of supply for Turkey, a lot of question marks linked to all of them, right? Yeah. So there's no... I don't think this will be something that will be ironed out very easily or quickly.
I think, if I can jump in very quickly. One creative idea that we have not mentioned, which of course would not work to sell to Turkey, but the concept of using Cyprus as a conduit for Israeli gas to Egypt. Of course, there's been a deal to create a 400-kilometer pipeline from the Cyprus fields to Egypt to provide natural gas that way. There is very creative ideas to send Israeli gas towards Cyprus, then pipe it back down. Of course, this is a very long way around, but it does at least alleviate that political problem where, again, you're simply a U.S. energy company selling your gas from wherever that's coming from Cyprus to Egypt. And so that is one creative way to move around the political obstacles.
It's interesting how politics can change what's efficient economically. Before I open it up to questions, and I will in just a second, I have one question for you, Zach, and this is kind of as a security analyst. Is there any way to build a more secure pipeline? How do you make a pipeline more secure? Is it just more patrols? Is it overflights? Yeah. What do you do to secure a pipeline?
That's a great question. It's a lot of patrol is the main issue, but real patrol of troops that know what they're doing. There are only a very small number of points in which the Sinai pipeline comes up above ground. In fact, if you look at where the explosions take place, again, there have been more than 30 explosions. They're the same handful of places that exist over time. There are points in the switch line where the pipeline pops above ground to go to a switch terminal to check the pressure and all that. And so these are the same areas that are over and over being attacked. So I believe there's only been one instance where the militants actually dug underground to get to the pipeline. So for the record, they have and they can dig underground. But for the most part, they're simply attacking the same stations over and over.
Soft target.
And so it's a relatively soft target. There is minimal security. There have been instances where security has run away as soon as there's a threat. And frankly, this is the case not just around the gas terminals. This is the case in many checkpoints in Sinai. There's also the instances where we've seen militants take the station completely by surprise and actually hold the individual hostage inside. Regularly, they're not simply blowing up the pipeline. They're actually blowing up the station itself. Mm. And of course, this requires quick fixing, which Egypt has not done because the authorities are not willing to go out into the desert, into dangerous territory, and they don't. You know, you'd need a battalion to protect one guy fixing the station. And frankly, a lot of the pipeline attacks, many of them have been claimed by Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, which is now a stated affiliate of the Islamic State. but many of them are also, and many of them are probably carried out by local Bedouin who have grievances against the state for a number of reasons, one of which is the gas line, which they see as a resource from their land being pulled out of the ground, being sold abroad, especially if it's to Israel, but being sold elsewhere to absolutely zero benefit to them. There were times when they, prior to the revolution, where they would put up with that, where apparently they were probably paid under the table by Israelis or by the Egyptians to actually guard the pipeline itself. Now they're simply main grievances. So addressing some of those grievances, whether it is providing a payout from some of the gas sale, or providing some sort of services or jobs in the industry to the local population, is another way to make sure that that local population, which is very protective of its territory, is protective of the pipeline in its territory.
Interesting. Well, let's open it up to questions from the audience here. I think we have a microphone, so. Put your hand up, we'll recognize you, say your name and affiliation, and ask, the floor is open. So, who wants to lead us off? Yes, I see one right here.
Henry, after research now, I wondered where would you place the quality level of production of all these gas resources when comparing it to other hotspots, the problem, you know, in Iraq with ISIS, Libya with their problems of their diverse groups, they still are able to produce and pump and supply people. At what rate, though? And what rate would this be? Would investors have to be wary of what's going to occur here as far as, you know, to ensure a profitable level of production?
Well, we can both. I think you gave part of the answer already. But I don't think it compares in any way with what's going on in Iraq or in Libya. There is some concern about infrastructure safety, as Zach described, pipelines, and if you would construct an LNG terminal, which a debate that has finally calmed down a little bit. But if you would, there was some debate then of how do you secure an LNG terminal. I don't think that will be built, so that concern I don't think is too valid. So there's some, but look, as you rightly say, you can produce natural gas. I think the relevant question is, I think the most important issue to address is, can the authorities and the companies that have to extract the gas come to some form of meaningful agreement, stable agreement? Can the production start, and then can the gas be marketed in the region? And I think those are the questions that are first and foremost important, not security issues.
I think that's right. Zach?
The only thing I would say about quality of production is that Israel being new to offshore, Noble Energy made a large investment in the actual production and the ability of Israeli employees to pull it out of the ground. So that's something I think that should be considered when Israel is going over whether or not there's a monopoly, and the amount of investment that the outside companies have already put into the fields, and now saying you can no longer control the field after putting all this investment into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Another one in the back there.
Can you hear me okay? Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. This was actually really insightful. I had a quick question for Tim, that you had mentioned that solutions in the Netherlands and other parts of the world are maybe not great solutions for Israel. But I saw a story a couple weeks ago that the head of Israel's antitrust authority went to the Netherlands to learn something from the area. So can you expand on that, what he was hoping to learn? And why it isn't necessarily effective?
And I'm sorry, what was your name?
I'm Marav. I'm a Syracuse grad student.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks. I'm sure there are many lessons that one can learn from looking to other cases. The specific report that I referred, so the Shishinsky study looked at royalty regimes in particular, wanted to establish whether the existing royalty rate was in any way comparable to what is going on in other parts of the world. I think that's what and I think that comparison may be a little flawed. I think there can be many lessons from other countries. The Netherlands has, as Andrew was referring to, an established gas industry. It's been producing gas since the early 60s. So arguably, in terms of regulatory climate, there are lessons to be learned. I know a little of this visit. I know that it was a big delegation from Israel that went to the Netherlands. Historically, there have always been strong ties between the two countries, and there are industry interests, vice versa. So I'm not sure who catered this, but surely there was more to it than just energy, but this was a mission to extract, do some fact-finding from the Israeli side in the Netherlands, and the, you know, have conversations with ministry representatives, regulatory authorities, and others to see whether there are lessons to be learned. Whether they actually did, I don't know. I wasn't there.
Interesting. Well, great. Any final thoughts before we close for the closed session?
Let me end on a bit of optimism.
Good.
Not optimism, please. But opportunity for optimism. How about that? You should not be optimistic from what I'm going to say, but there's an opportunity for optimism. And that's that, frankly, the Israeli gas find and the partners for purchase create a real incentive to peace. You know, one of the markers that Erdogan has laid down for buying Israeli gas is that Egypt changes its policy towards Gaza. Of course, going back to Egypt, there's a controversy of normalcy with Israel as long as the Palestinian issue is unsettled. And even if we look at Jordan, of course, Jordan's a much smaller market, and but it also has a very close ties for many reasons to Jerusalem, to the Palestinian cause. So there are opportunities for showing that this is one place in which regional peace can create economic incentives and opportunities for Israel. Again, I wouldn't be optimistic that that's going to convince the government to move forward tomorrow, but it is at least an incentive to think about.
Yeah, so my background's as an economist, you know, it kind of seems like eventually supply and demand, where there's a supply and where there's demand, we'll figure out a way to get that there. The politics gets in the way, and there are some serious, serious political differences in this area, and have been for many years. But ultimately, not every time, but if you look back through history, ultimately, where there's a supply and where there's a demand, if you can figure out the price, that's going to be, the lines will cross eventually.
May I
sure.
Very briefly, I think you need peace before development takes place. And so the Gaza Marine field that we looked at is a relatively small field. Here you have a lot of demand offshore, in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
Shortages of electricity, shortages of water, which you could desalinate, you would need more electricity for. The BG Group has been working to get that field with the Israeli authorities to see whether they can get that field into production for roughly 15 years now, and it has not come to fruition, and quite frankly, I'm not sure it will. We'll also have to wait and see what happens to BG to start with. Now it's been taken over, but that's another issue. But so this is, without stable conditions and peace, it is very difficult to get that investment off the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more.